Welcome to Green and Red, Scrappy Politics for Scrappy People, a regular podcast on radical, environmental and anti-capitalist politics, brought to you by Bob Bazanko and Scott Parkin.
Welcome to the Green and Red podcast. I'm your co-host Scott Parkin in Berkeley, California this morning. And as always, I am joined by...
It's Bob Bazanko in Niles, Ohio. And today, really excited because we're going to be talking to a historian who has really made a mark in the field and deals with a topic that's really important today, probably America's preeminent historian of McCarthyism and the Red Scare, Ellen Schrecker. Professor Schrecker is currently professor emerita from Yeshiva University. She has a PhD from Harvard and has taught at, among others, Harvard and NYU and Princeton. Among her many books, I'm just going to mention the ones on McCarthyism because the list is quite voluminous, is The Lost Promise, American Universities in the 1960s, The Lost Soul of Higher Education, Corporatization, The Assault on Academic Freedom and the End of the American University, Cold War Triumphalism, American Inquisition, The Era of McCarthyism. And I think from my perspective, the ones I've used in class and were very well known were Many Are the Crimes, which is a kind of magisterial work about McCarthyism in America, and McCarthyism, or No Ivory Tower, McCarthyism in the University. Welcome to our podcast, Ellen Schrecker. Thank you so much for joining us. Let's start. Recently, you had an article in The Nation titled Worse Than McCarthyism, Universities in the Age of Trump. And this is something the students actually ask me all the time. What is today like compared to McCarthyism? You come out and you say, what's happening now is far worse than McCarthyism. So you just want to take us through that and how you reach that.
Sure. I finally found a metaphor. I've been writing most of my life, and I never came up with a metaphor. And now I found one, because McCarthyism is like a gentle breeze compared to the Gale Force 5 hurricane coming out of the White House. My first metaphor, and I think that says it all, what we're seeing is infinitesimally worse. It's just unbelievable. Just when you think they couldn't have thought of something more damaging and unconstitutional, they kick all the foreign students out of Harvard. It's bing, bing, bing every day on a different front and in a different way. And they're amazingly clever. Really clever. They understand better than most people within the academic community, by the way. They understand what makes universities work and how we can dismantle them. And that's what they're doing.
Well, what do you think the larger project is? Because universities in the 60s, obviously, and we'll talk about that, were really a force for kind of activism and change, but not as much recently. Why are they taking these really harsh measures against a problem that in their mind is very big and enormous, whereas I would think it is?
I agree with you that universities have lost between the 1960s and now, have lost a lot of credibility and power within American society. And I think you're right that the current attack on universities is really only one piece of a much broader project of essentially dismantling our constitutional republic, dismantling a government by the people for the people. And they're doing an extremely good job of that. And we are ending up to become, at the moment, an authoritarian, undemocratic country. And it's going to be very hard to roll that back. But I don't think we have any choice. These are not, Trump is unique in being uniquely irrational. And like McCarthy, that's one of the things that he shared with Joseph McCarthy, except
along with Roy Cohn. They shared Roy Cohn. Yeah.
But also, he has a lot more power than McCarthy ever had. And that irrationality makes it particularly hard to deal with because you simply don't know what's coming down the pike, who he will make deals with, who he won't make deals with. Will he even keep his deals? Probably not, because it depends on who he was talking to the night before at Mar-a-Lago, who paid $1 million to play, pick up his golf tees. Who knows?
Part of the frame here is around anti-Semitism, and the Trump administration, as well as like the Biden administration before, really tried to weaponize anti-Semitism to go after people who were protesting the genocide in Gaza. But it's much bigger than just that, because we also see a lot of critique of like this, at least within the circles on the right, of like far left ideologies. They want to roll back women's studies programs and African-American studies programs, Chicano studies programs, and things like that. I'm wondering if you could actually just talk a little bit about how it's broader than what's in the current media narrative.
Yeah, it still is in the current media narrative. Of course, this big attack in almost everything, talking about how DEI programs for diversity, equity, and inclusion are really discrimination, racial discrimination stuff. They're fighting against truth. They're fighting against all the democratic reforms of the 1960s, whereas McCarthyism was trying to roll back the New Deal with very little success, but they sure caused a lot of harm within universities, within the State Department, within American culture. But what Trump's administration is trying to do is much broader. It really is trying to disassemble a democratic political regime and doing very well by it.
Just today or late yesterday, Florida rejected the guy from Michigan, Santa Ono, as their new president.
Oh, right.
Because he's too woke. That's another one of the words they like to use. And one thing that I really remember when I read your works originally that was really important to me was how a lot of these groups who were attacked kind of self-censored. Unions and universities and so on. And now we're obviously seeing that where they're called in these kind of, I call them show trials, where they bring the president of Columbia or Penn or whoever up. And how would you compare the way universities themselves, the administrators and the professors are responding today compared to the McCarthyite era?
Okay. I would say up until very recently, I'd say it was identical. That both the universities during McCarthyism and the universities basically throughout their history in it, have always folded in the face of strong political attacks, have always folded during McCarthyism. People have asked me about that. What schools resisted? Where was the resistance? And I said, there's no resistance. The only resistance came from the victims themselves. Of course, they're fighting for their careers. And a sort of handful of left-wing civil libertarians, mainly lawyers, mainly people who were in or near the Communist Party. And that was it. That was it for the resistance. And clearly, they didn't get very far. I can discuss what ended McCarthyism because it is interesting and relevant to what's happening today. But what is happening today that's different is that for the first time in the history of American higher education, there is resistance coming from organized groups like the ACLU and the UP, the American Association of University Professors, that during McCarthyism blended into the wallpaper. They didn't do a thing. Now they're on the front lines, recruiting like crazy. They're getting foundation money and things like that to fight. Whether they will be able to win is another question. We don't exactly have a Supreme Court that's going to assist very much. So we have to count them out. And Congress is certainly in the business of rolling over and giving Trump anything he wants. And so are the American people. That's the thing that's terrifying. Was, I think, the scariest thing I read was a few days ago that talked about focus groups looking at people who voted for Trump and finding that they approve of everything he does. And he did win the election. And presumably, if there was another election, he could win again, especially now that he controls the government and probably knocks many people out of the country and off the voter rolls and stuff. But there is resistance. There's the president of Harvard, who has collaborated a lot with the Trump administration, nonetheless woke up and smelled the coffee and realized that he wasn't going to get anywhere by collaborating, and maybe the time had come to stand up. And it certainly had come, and he's gotten a lot of support. And it is stiffening backbones that should have long been stiffened before. Mainly, I think, because what the Trump administration is doing is so outrageous that it can't be ignored. A college president really can't maintain his or her self-respect by giving in to letting the administration determine what courses to teach and who to hire and who to admit to their institutions. And then going, if you say, oh, of course we're going to change the syllabi and we'd never teach a course, the American Revolution, we would call it the American Fight for Independence. We don't use the word revolution anymore. When that kind of silliness is so out there and so provocative, it's probably very hard for people to roll over and say, oh, yes, of course, we're not going to do that. So I think we're seeing what we didn't see during McCarthyism, which is a call for collective action within the higher education world, from disciplinary societies, from alumni. There's a group that I discovered very serendipitously called Crimson Courage. Have you ever heard of it?
No.
Harvard alumni.
Oh, okay. Sure.
10,000 men of Harvard. So they sit around and they go, 10,000 men of Harvard are very proud of President Garber for standing up. And schools like Harvard depend on their alumni for a little bit of cash. Yeah. We know in this world money talks. And these may be voices that will be listened to by other universities as well as Harvard.
It seems like Trump is trying to strike at with everything that we've seen since January, is really trying to strike at the heart, before January, strike at the heart of the Democratic coalition. They're going after, they've been laying off federal workers and going after universities. Like, nonprofits are also very concerned about them coming after them with their tech status. And in an almost like comical way, Trump has actually also been talking about laying tariffs on foreign films coming into the U.S. And one of the more notorious episodes of the McCarthy era was the Hollywood 10. And I'm wondering if you think that there's also going to be, because Hollywood is a big supporter of obviously like liberal causes and Democratic Party candidates and things. I'm wondering if you also think that there will be some drive to go after these culture makers, these creators.
Definitely. And I think it's been underway for quite a while. After all, there was a film this year about Palestine that won an Academy Award and couldn't find a distributor. That is collaboration with the forces of repression. We do have to look at the involvement of the Palestine issue, especially since Trump is, what shall we say, trumpeting Semitism as some kind of a boogeyman that he uses to coerce different groups within American society. And I think certainly the sort of culture makers of our society are being affected and have been affected for quite a while. So a lot of this isn't new. What Trump did was accelerate and intensify what had been going on in universities, within Hollywood, within book publishing, I think, and in a number of ways. And just a whiff of repression seems to cause people to pull back and censor themselves. What's hard to find is things that didn't happen. In other words, what courses weren't taught, what professors weren't hired. There are few cases. I remember several years ago, a very eminent Middle Eastern scholar was on the verge of being hired at Yale, and that appointment, Juan Cole, you remember that case?
Juan Cole, and then Steve Salada at Illinois, too. Yeah.
So that kind of thing usually doesn't get attention in the mass media, but I have a feeling that it's pretty prevalent throughout universities, throughout Hollywood. There certainly were blacklists everywhere. During McCarthyism, there was a major blacklist within the academic community. There was the famous Hollywood blacklist, and I wrote a lot about that because I got into the papers of some of the blacklisters, and it was amazing what was happening. Producers were circulating a list of somebody they wanted to hire to these quasi-official blacklisters, and they'd go over their lists, usually culled from letterheads of left-wing organizations, and said, oh, no, he sent a letter of congratulations to the Moscow Art Theater in 1937. You can't possibly let him do the film score, the music score for your film. It was across the board. It wasn't just directors and actors, but electricians, the whole thing. Yeah. Unions were implicated in this as well.
The CIO fired many of its best organizers because they were somehow associated with the Communist Party. I just retired from Texas, and the timing's good, actually, because Texas just now has a state law where the regents have taken over curriculum, syllabus. Even they want a role in hiring, and they're going to institute what I call a snitch line, where students can anonymously call up and report on their professors, which is really terrifying because a student doesn't get the grade he or she wants, and boom, you're the next thing. And did that happen? That kind of openly in the 50s, or was it more done subtly, covertly?
It was pretty covert. I was always on the lookout for something like that, like angry ex-wife in a contestant.
Yeah.
I found one or two, mainly looking at loyalty security cases in the government. Would I have found them in private industry? Maybe. The FBI was circulating what they called, they had a program they called the Responsibilities Program. Have you ever heard of it?
I don't know about that one. I probably came across it.
Yeah. They were consulted by governors who didn't want tainted individuals on the faculties of their public colleges and universities. They would send an agent with a piece of paper, just a plain blank piece of paper. They would call it non-letterhead, so it didn't show that it came from the FBI, that just listed that person's affiliations with sort of communist-led organizations, like you gave money to the Folk Music Society of Westchester County or something like that. And people would be fired or not hired. And that went on. I know about this responsibilities program in higher education, but people who couldn't get jobs in higher education, who I had interviewed, said that same thing was happening to them if they tried to get a job in the private sector as well. So there was a FBI-led blacklisting program. They'd say it was a matter of national security.
I've been on search committees been alerted to them where subtly people were using ideology. They wouldn't come out and say it, but they clearly were trying to shy away from candidates who they perceived as being too far to the left or whatever. But it was done subtly, whereas now what you're seeing, especially like in Florida, Texas, is so open. And I think that's the chilling part of it, where people, on the other hand, I guess maybe scholars won't be applying for jobs in states like that.
I just want to say that there's another form of blacklist.
Yeah.
Who are pretty sure that nobody's going to hire them from.
Yeah, if I were young, I would be applying for jobs at the University of Houston today.
Yeah. Exactly. So, yeah. So it's this combination. It's what was called during the McCarthy period, the black silence of fear, that people didn't talk about it. And when somebody was fired, not publicly, if you are called before the House Un-American Activities Committee or Senator McCarthy's committee or the Senate Internal Security Subcommittee, which was really very vicious, that was public and you'd know you were being blacklisted. But the other stuff was not public and both parties wanted to keep it secret. The schools didn't want it public at all because they didn't want even the fact that somebody who had once been in or near communism was on their faculty in the first place. And the people who were fired certainly didn't want it known because that if they weren't being targeted by the FBI, and the FBI was not 100% accurate and did slip up in a few cases. And there were cases, some of them I love, of left-wing activists who get funded, especially in the sciences, by the Navy and the Air Force.
Yeah.
Or even the Atomic Energy System.
Yeah. The famous historian William Appleman Williams taught at West Point.
And I had people who, especially in the 60s, when the academic world was expanding so quickly that they couldn't really do loyalty security investigations of everybody who's being hired, and especially if they were in the field of molecular biology, who's going to worry about that?
Yeah.
You had actually mentioned earlier about how McCarthy, one of the interesting things you find, which is maybe relevant to this moment, is how McCarthyism ended. I'm wondering if you could actually talk a little bit about that.
Yeah.
Or a lot, however you want to go.
I'd love to talk all day about that one because it's really interesting. As a historian, of course, we are aware that there is this thing called multi-causality, that there are many things. If we can find a cause, often we can't find a cause here, I think what we have is a lot of different causes coalescing at a moment. In the mid to late 50s, it runs out of steam. Of course, we are all aware of how George Clooney seemed to destroy McCarthy with the big hit on Broadway that is making a case, and a case can be made, that the newscaster Edward R. Murrow had a big role here in publicizing McCarthy's misdeeds. And he certainly did play a role, but there were many other ways in which McCarthyism, besides Joseph McCarthy himself, began to fade from the forefront of American politics. And one was simply the people who were leading the public attack on the communist danger. People like McCarthy, people like Richard Nixon, people like all the people in HUAC were doing it to get attention, to boost their careers. They were opportunistic politicians. Just we could say that Ron DeSantis is an opportunistic politician who jumped onto the attack on the woke universities. That was really the motivation of a lot of these politicians who probably wouldn't have known a communist from an anti-communist. But what happened was the public got a little bored. They had run out of the movie stars. They had run out of the State Department people who had, quote unquote, sold China to the communists.
Yeah, it was China.
Yeah, which was really a way to attack the Truman administration. And they were, who really cares about a woman's gym teacher in Dubuque, Iowa? That's just not going to cut it. That's part of it. They ran out of witches. But also, and I think really the most important reason why it ended, was that there were real important political and social issues that needed to be addressed. And going after communism was not the way to deal with it. And this was, of course, the moment when the civil rights movement begins to dominate American domestic politics. And quite frankly, that within universities, for example, the people who had been active in the civil rights movement are also the people that by the 1960s are beginning to become active in the anti-war movement against Vietnam. Yeah. It's a direct line, as you probably know this. The people at the University of Michigan who invented the teach-ins, which I think was crucial for jump-starting the anti-war movement, had been active in the main civil rights movement. So I think we can see that what was ending McCarthyism was that there were so many other issues now within the United States that needed to be addressed. And the mainstream, which was willing to tolerate McCarthyism, the mainstream, what would we call it, liberal Democrats, had gone along with McCarthyism. Hubert Humphrey, who had put a civil rights plank in the 1948 Democratic presidential election, in the 1950, suggests that the United States create concentration camps for communists if there's a state of emergency. The mainstream of liberal democracy had been collaborating with McCarthyism, but they pulled back.
And when the civil rights movement emerges, you have that the attempt to connect them, right, with people like Robeson or Harry Haywood or Du Bois, yeah. Where basically the argument is civil rights is communist inspired because the good, at the time they would have said, the good Negroes aren't doing that kind of thing.
The NAACP, quote unquote, house cleaned.
Right, yeah. Du Bois was the founder and he left. Why didn't that work? That kind of peters out fairly. Obviously, Robeson is a victim and others are victims, but it doesn't really stick. Why do you think that was?
Because I think this was a rare moment when the mainstream American institutions of civil society and the government were genuinely liberal.
Yeah.
I think that, and also, of course, as Mary Duziak and others have shown, the Cold War ironically plays a role here because the Russians are accusing the Americans of, look at what you're doing. You've got Jim Crow in the South and there are regimes. And the government says, oh my gosh, we got to do something about that. And they did. They had. So that's part of the reason. In other words, it's very multi-causality.
Yeah. How would you compare this current surge of banning books and trying to ban courses, literally thoughts even, right? Yeah. To the earliest phases of McCarthyism. It seems, and again, I'm dealing with it, this is not my specific field, but it seems like now we're seeing these kind of overt book bannings. And they're just like in Texas, they're going to the libraries and carting out hundreds of books based on one parent complaining. I don't recall reading in your work and others that was as prevalent in the first phase of McCarthyism.
It did exist. There was an attempt to scrub the libraries overseas. Remember, there were USIA, American,
sure.
U.S. Yeah. libraries. And McCarthy and Roy Cohn and his buddy David Schein went overseas and looked at the libraries and engaged in pillow fights in hotel lobbies. God only knows what they were doing. But anyhow, what was happening, there was that attempt, and there were these organizations, right-wing women's groups, mothers' groups, the kinds of things that exist now, but they weren't as prevalent as they are now. It's a much bigger, nastier movement at this point because they are going after ideas. They're going after words. And also, during the McCarthy period, people censored themselves.
Yeah.
There was a lot of censorship. And you don't have that kind of censorship within the universities today. The 60s intervened.
Yeah.
And people just wouldn't, I think, won't stand for having their syllabi if they can help it. The problem is the administrations, college administrations and university administrations have been folding ever since. Ron DeSantis says, let's get rid of teaching about the civil rights movement. And that's it for teaching about the civil rights movement.
Yeah.
But we're also seeing within like the universities today, even though we see like Alan Garber and Harvard standing up to Trump, but we're also seeing Harvard like revoking the diplomas of Palestine solidarity students and things like that. And so there's still a huge level of self-censorship going on as well. Like the NYU just revoked the diploma of one of their top students, Logan Rosos.
And that's been going on, again, mainly with regard to Palestine. We can't overlook what has been called the Palestine exception. They will talk about free speech on campus, but they'll cancel lectures or films or probably hiring. Oh, yeah. The Harvard fired the top two leaders of its Middle East Center. So, yes, at the same time that Alan Garber is refusing to let Trump have veto power over faculty hiring, he's still giving in over Palestine issues, I think.
The revoking of diplomas really struck me because I've read a bit about this. I'm certainly not an expert, but that I thought was, I hadn't really been familiar with that before. Usually when people get their diplomas revoked, it's about maybe plagiarism or something like that.
Yeah.
Is this kind of, was that really prevalent as well in the 50s and 60s? Just actually like revoking the.
Students were kicked out.
Yeah.
University of Chicago kicked out more students than any school. And that was clever. They didn't call the police. There was a months of a sit-in, and the president at the time, he was provost and then president, Edward Leavy, then becomes attorney general. He saved his reputation and kicked out a lot of students who then became weathermen, but that's another issue.
Yeah.
But there were no student protests during McCarthyism. Students were involved with panty raids and football queens and stuff like that. I was trying to be political. I was an undergraduate at Radcliffe Harvard at the time and looking for some kind of political activity I could join. And I never found anything beyond the Radcliffe Young Democrats. And that was when Kennedy was a senator from Massachusetts, and I sat on a stage with him once. That was it. That was my it wasn't my political activity. I did some door-to-door canvassing for local Democratic candidates, but that was political activity until the civil rights movement. Then I went out and picketed Woolworths, things like that.
I have lots of questions. One thing I'm interested in is like post-60s, we see this almost like neo-McCarthyite, like people like David Horowitz and Phyllis Schlafly, who are critical and saying that the University of Phys have been taken over by radicals. I believe they actually say that Stephen Miller, who's one of Trump's like whisperers, is actually a protege of David Horowitz, the recently late David Horowitz. But people like Horowitz weren't really mainstream, what we saw with McCarthyism or like what we're seeing in this particular moment. I'm just wondering if you could actually talk a little bit about that sort of David Horowitz far right sort of movement that happened in between the 60s and now.
And it's connected. There's not a massive disconnect. The people who are far on the right had been organizing themselves in the 50s, not publicly so much. You probably know about the Powell memo. Do you know that? This was during, let's go back to the 60s. There was a backlash against the 60s within the university, within civil society. Lots of politicians got on board. including somebody who we've all heard of named Ronald Reagan, who owes his initial political career to bashing the Berkeley free speech movement when he ran for governor of California in 1966. So there has always been that kind of opposition to the universities in the political world. It wasn't as powerful as it clearly is today, but it was there. And in the early 70s, after the Nixon's invasion of Cambodia, which ignited protests on a number of campuses, including Kent State in Ohio, where four people were killed, and Jackson State in Mississippi, where two were, and there were other killings as well. You had a massive right-wing attack on higher education. And a number of very conservative, we might call them reactionary, billionaires, oil men, people like the Koch brothers, a number of foundations, somebody named Richard Mellon Scaife, were putting millions, by now it's probably hundreds of millions of dollars, into a campaign against these, what they viewed as a left-wing takeover of the media, of the legal profession, and especially of the universities. And what they were trying to do was create a sort of alternative intelligentsia. They created right-wing think tanks. They created publications. They subsidized academic programs, especially in economics and in law. They began to provide an alternative to academic knowledge. And this has had terrible consequences. We can see that today in the current Secretary of Health, Health and Welfare, in particular, you know, that there's phony medicine out there subsidizing scholarship that would somehow deny the danger of climate change, deny the role of the oil industry, and whose money is being used to subsidize this campaign. It is, in fact, wealthy oil men, among others, big pharma, among others. Anyhow, what we're seeing is a very self-conscious and very successful movement among these right-wing billionaires to skew American political culture to the right. And that includes delegitimizing academic knowledge. And it's been, unfortunately, very successful. So that now the David Horowitzes of the world can say, college professors don't believe in free speech. It's just their opinion. And it's very dangerous. And the academic community has not figured out how to combat, because these right-wing polemicists are using the tactics of the left. They're using, for example, Title VI of the Civil Rights Act to claim that a DEI program, a program to afford more opportunity for students with poor backgrounds in earlier education can catch up. Not that they're stupid, but that they've just been poorly educated, because we haven't even talked about the attack on elementary schools, public elementary education, which is, of course, part of this program as well. When you ask about how this is happening, it is part of a self-conscious program. And this document, the Powell Memo of 1971, which everybody should Google immediately, spells it out. Powell is Lawrence, what's his name? What is his
Lewis.
Lewis Powell. Thank you.
He was with the FTC at the time, right?
No way. No. Lewis Powell was, among other things, the head of the American Bar Association. He was a, I would love to write a book about him, but I'm going to try and write an article. He's a lawyer, probably the most preeminent lawyer in the state of Virginia. He was involved with the most powerful law firm in Richmond. Now, he was also tapped before that, after 1954, when Brown versus Board of Education was decided, and the state of Virginia did not want to desegregate. And the governor, he was Harry Byrd, who was running a thoroughly segregated state, called on the top lawyer in Richmond, Lewis Powell, to help him with how do you avoid desegregating. And Powell became very active. He was doing a lot of pro bono work in education, in public education in Virginia, became head of the Virginia School Board, became head of the state, whatever the would be like the regents, maybe, but the sort of state commission on higher education, and did very well by avoiding desegregation during his tenure as the head of the Richmond School Board. He desegregated Richmond schools by two young girls. That was it. Then he writes this memo setting out a campaign. He's consulted by a friend, I think, who is about to become head of the Education Committee of the Chamber of Commerce, which is the nation's leading business organization, probably. And he gives this guy advice on how the business community should fight against the reforms of the 60s, setting up alternative organizations, getting rid, if they possibly can, of left-wing professors, taking over the legal system. So you see him setting out this whole agenda for a right-wing, what can we say? It's not a coup, but a takeover of American political, what would you call it, institutions, I think. He then, of course, participates in a number of important decisions, including the most famous one with regard to affirmative action, which is Bakke versus the University of California, Davis, which gets rid of affirmative action as such, and in its place creates the notion of diversity as the only justification for giving opportunity to members of racial minorities. That's a good piece of work Justice Powell has done. And of course, as a faculty member at a private institution of higher learning, he affected my career and probably my salary because he made it impossible for private institutions to unionize their faculties.
So yeah, you mentioned
done a lot of damage.
Yeah, you mentioned that backlash to the 60s, and it's really crucial. In class, I'll mention, like in Eisenhower's farewell address, he speaks of universities as well as the military-industrial complex. He says university education is a substitute for getting government, people are trying to get government contracts now. And then even when SDS started, it's about a lot of things, participatory democracy, Vietnam. But one of their big issues is what they call the multiversity at the time. And like in California, it's Clark Kerr and all the defense contracts. You have the Michigan State Group doing stuff with Vietnam. And on that, a lot of the groups that you just mentioned with Powell were like ALEC and Heritage, who are still very active today. And you have J.D. Vance, professors of the enemy. So the long-winded point, but you also mentioned there's a component of kind of the way the economy changed, the way American society changed in that period, right? Increasing corporatization, neoliberalism, massive cuts in federal funding for education. How does that all play into this increasing kind of conservatism and these attacks on the university? Yeah,
this is a turning point. You can put a date on it, which is 1973 and the oil embargo and the realization that the United States, until then unchallenged economic primacy in the world, is beginning to be challenged, and we're beginning to look at deindustrialization, the end of paid unionized jobs in heavy industry that you could raise a family on without having gone to college. And this puts new pressures on higher education, because now it is supposed to be the vehicle for social mobility within the American economy. And that's not its job. That's doesn't give out good jobs. That has to be done somewhere else. But the universities pick up on it. They tout themselves as going to help people move up. And there is evidence, of course, that people with academic credentials, BAs, do better than people who don't have them. But that's not because of what they're learning in college. It's because of the destruction of unions. It's the destruction of heavy industry. It's for a whole bunch of other reasons, a part of the backlash. But what it does is give higher education a bigger footprint within American society than it had previously, and thus making it more vulnerable, because people become very disillusioned. You spend $50,000 a year on tuition for your kids, and what do they come out being? If they're lucky, they get a gig at Starbucks.
I think we're getting near the end of our time. My other question is thinking about this, like, economic piece. It's like the wealth gap is like wider than it's been ever, or not ever, but like in a long time. And the right seems to continue to pile up with like culture war, right? Talking about trans athletes, and they've actually somehow merged climate change into this. And I'm just wondering if what as the sort of what can be like a next step for people who are involved in organizing and politics, and people who are want, there's a lot of people who want to challenge this sort of authoritarian, you know, shift by the Trump administration that was happening before Trump came in, because they were challenging what the Democrats were doing too, who also have the, who had this neoliberal economic project and things like that. I'm just wondering what you can see people who are organizing should be doing.
More organizing, obviously. That I'm very active with the AUP, American Association of University Professors, and we recently had transitional of the top leadership, much more oriented toward organizing on campuses. And I think that's a place to start for academics, is just saturating the institution that you're operating within with meetings, with vigils, with demonstrations, like the 60s. And I will end with what gives me hope. It's a recent book, I'm sure you know it, Bob, by Rusty Eisenberg.
I know Rusty, yeah.
About Nixon and Kissinger. And she subjected herself to years of listening to the Nixon tapes and came out with a rather surprising finding, which was the impact of the student unrest on Nixon's decision to begin pulling out of Vietnam, which is astonishing to me, but he was paying a lot of attention to it. And so what it shows is that there we are out there marching. I was too old to take over buildings, but a lot of my younger friends did. And making what John Lewis, of course, calls good trouble. And it was having an impact. Now, it took a long time, years. But ultimately, it did have that impact. And the interesting thing that I found totally serendipitously in an archive, I always feel, oh, great, I found it. But was that when the anti-war movement began in 19, basically we can we have a date for that, as it were, in the spring of 1965. The leading figures within major institutions of higher learning and elsewhere supported the war. This was anti-communism. We were afraid that the dominoes were going to fall. It was common sense that communism had to be resisted in Vietnam. And that changed. That common sense began to seem especially stupid because you just weren't going to get rid of the Vietnamese people. We weren't quite as bad as the Israelis today, but we were pretty bad.
Close, yeah.
And I'm looking through the Harvard archives as I was looking to see what the conservative faculty members who had organized themselves were doing and how they talked about it and everything, and discovered, and you don't want to know about the Harvard archives, they're useless. They never catalog. But I'm going through this guy's papers, and the way it's organized is A, B, C, D, E. I swear to God, that's how it, as a historian, you can imagine, can't possibly find anything that way. But there was a manila envelope sitting there. I thought, manila envelope, maybe it's important. Pull it out. And there's a correspondence between about a dozen super duper eminent Harvard professors and Lyndon Johnson in the summer of 1967. And what I found was these guys, Nobel Prize winners, major economists, deans, just really the elite of the elite. But they hadn't been participating publicly in anything to do with Vietnam. And they say that, they write, and somehow I forget their language, but they let on that we are the most eminent people at Harvard who have not yet said anything about Vietnam. In other words, we don't pay attention to John Kenneth Galbraith, and you shouldn't either. But what they're saying to Johnson is, we're so glad you are beginning to think about changing things in Vietnam, and we offer our help. Now, what that means is that they have given up on Vietnam, and that begins to show up. They begin to criticize things. They criticize the invasion of Cambodia. This is 1970. It's 5 years after the war has really escalated. But why are they doing that? It's because there has been an anti-war movement in their own institutions that they can no longer ignore. I guess my advice is, whatever you're doing, keep it up, intensify it as best you can, and listen. That's what the leaders of American universities have never done, is listen to their own students.
One last thing, because this is probably, I've heard more about this maybe than anything else in the last 10 or 12 years. Our grad students are already deeply in debt. Like, many of them are in six figures, 100,000 or more. Yeah. And then I don't know how many courses are now being taught by adjuncts who are, for 30 years at the University of Houston, you get $3,000, hasn't gone up a bit, and obviously no benefits. How much of that, I think part of that, you're creating this precarious kind of contingent group of workers, and that's TAs. If TAs weren't doing the grading, I don't know what we would do. I know, believe me. Because I haven't graded a test, and I can't tell you the last time I graded a blue book, but how much does that worry you, that we have this group now who you can't speak out because you can fire at will, you have no legal rights. There's a group here in Texas, Collin College, these women who we interviewed here a couple years ago, who were fired for just simply questioning the COVID protocol for return, for wearing masks, basically. How much does that concern you, and how much is that different?
That's completely different. People didn't have TAs, and certainly not at the more selective institutions, but I think everywhere. Actually, I was on a committee of the AUP that was looking into this, very ambitious, looking into the state of academic freedom and higher education connected with it. We were operating a little over a year ago until Trump came in and then disappeared. But we were allowed to pick some aspect of higher education that we felt would impact on academic freedom. And I said, contingent labor, that is the biggest problem within the university, and it's not widely discussed. Because I think the powers that be are too embarrassed by it to realize that if they knew, and the percentage of contingent gig workers, they are called, part-time or without, on contracts temporarily with no chance of tenure, or let's not use the word tenure, let's use the word no job security. All they want is the same security that full-time, they want full-time jobs and they want the same security that other people have in other sectors of society. This is by far the biggest problem within higher education. And it's the same percentage at Harvard as it is at Nassau County Community College. It's prevalent everywhere. And of course, what Trump wants to do and his people want to do is get rid of them altogether. That's the push for AI. I think it's the push for AI everywhere is to get rid of real human beings who do work. God only knows. I have granddaughters. It's pretty bad.
I figure where a student is actually now suing a professor for using AI, which I expect students to do a turn in papers and things, but I guess apparently professors are using this now too, which is really fairly worse.
Yeah.
Because like you, I spent hours, days, weeks inside archives, and that's how we learned what we learned. So it's very different now. And we'll have to have you on again because I have 2 hours at least more to say, but this has been really...
But yeah,
I appreciate this so much.
Problem is really big, and I'm so glad you brought it up and brought it up last. So that's the that our audience is going to take away with them, that the whole academic profession has been hollowed out, and the quality is probably declining as well. Don't want to say that. You have to either be a trust fund baby. And nobody's brought that up. Crazy.
Yeah. In a lot of smaller places now, a lot of our grad students are like adjuncting it. The department gives them the books, they give them the assignments. It's high school or whatever. Everybody's doing the same thing. You can't diverge. You use the same presentation. So it's like this ultimate conformity. And then it always reminds me of the 60s and SDS and everything else, Port Huron and everything else. Thank you so much. This is obviously an important topic. In the last few years, especially, students have been more intrigued by it. I started playing Margaret Chase Smith's speech in classes just to let them know. I really appreciate it. This is Professor Alan Schrecker, who's written multiple books on McCarthyism and the various forms of Red Scares. We've had scares, is always plural, right? Because this is nothing new. And it's very sobering. So we really appreciate everything you've done. And speaking with us today has been fantastic. So thank you so much.
Yeah, thank
you.
What
you guys are doing is helpful too. Really.
Really appreciate it.
I appreciate it.
This is my retirement gig.
Folks, if you like what you're hearing, please check us out on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Hit the subscribe button on YouTube if you're watching this on YouTube. Or if you want to make a donation, go to greenredpodcast.org and hit support or become a patron at patreon.com/greenredpodcast. Professor Schrecker, really appreciate you coming on. This has been a great conversation today. And hopefully we'll have you again sometime soon.
Thank you so much. I enjoyed it.